This is Audible.
Being the best in the world is seriously underrated. Audible presents The Dip by Seth Godin, read by the author. For more details on this program, including graphics, visit www.sethgodin.com/thedip. I feel like giving up. Almost every day, in fact. Not all day, of course, but there are moments. My bet is that you have those moments, too. If you're the kind of high-achieving, goal-oriented person who finds herself listening to a program like this, you're probably used to running into obstacles. Professional obstacles, personal obstacles, even obstacles related to personal fitness or winning board games. Most of the time, we deal with the obstacles by persevering. Sometimes we get discouraged and turn to inspirational writing, like stuff from Vince Lombardi. Quitters never win, and winners never quit. Bad advice. Winners quit all the time. They just quit the right stuff at the right time. Most people quit. They just don't quit successfully. In fact, many professions and many marketplaces profit from quitters. Society assumes you're going to quit. In fact, businesses and organizations count on it. If you learn about the systems that have been put in place that encourage quitting, you'll be more likely to beat them. And once you understand the common sinkhole that trips up so many people, I call it the dip, you'll be one step closer to getting through it. Extraordinary benefits accrue to the tiny minority of people who are able to push just a tiny bit longer than most. Extraordinary benefits also accrue to the tiny majority with the guts to quit early and refocus their efforts on something new. In both cases, it's about being the best in the world, about getting through the hard stuff and coming out on the other side. Quit the wrong stuff. Stick with the right stuff. Have the guts to do one or the other. Hannah Smith is a very lucky woman. She's a law clerk at the Supreme Court. She's the best in the world. Last year, more than 42,000 people graduated from law school in the United States, and 37 of them were awarded Supreme Court clerkships. Those 37 people are essentially guaranteed a job for life after they finish their year with the court. Top law firms routinely pay a signing bonus of $200,000 or more to any clerk they are able to hire. Clerks go on to become partners, judges, and senators. There are two things worth noting here. The first is that Hannah Smith isn't lucky at all. She's smart and focused and incredibly hardworking. And the second thing? That any one of the 42,000 people who graduated from law school last year could have had Hannah's job. Except they didn't. Not because they weren't smart enough or because they came from the wrong family. No, the reason that most of them didn't have a chance is that somewhere along the way, they quit. They didn't quit high school or college or law school. Instead, they quit in their quest to be the best in the world because the cost just seemed too high. This is a very short program about a very important topic, quitting. Believe it or not, quitting is often a great strategy, a smart way to manage your life and your career. Sometimes, though, quitting is exactly the wrong thing to do. It turns out that there's a pretty simple way to tell the difference. In addition to being smart and focused and incredibly hardworking, Hannah Smith is also a quitter. In order to get as far as she's gotten, she's quit countless other pursuits. You really can't try to do everything, especially if you intend to be the best in the world. Before we start on the quitting, though, you probably need to be sold on why being the best in the world matters so much. Our culture celebrates superstars. We reward the product or the song or the organization or the employee that is number one. The rewards are heavily skewed, so much so that it's typical for number one to get 10 times the benefit of number 10 and 100 times the benefit of number 100. According to the International Ice Cream Association, these are the top 10 flavors of ice cream: vanilla, chocolate, butter pecan, strawberry, Neapolitan, chocolate chip, French vanilla, cookies and cream, fudge ripple, and praline. You'd be forgiven if you assumed, as you assume with most lists, that the top-ranked flavors did a little bit better than the others. But in fact, vanilla does 4 times better than chocolate, which does better than most of the others put together. It's always like this. Almost always, anyway. It's called Zipf's Law, and it applies to resumes and college application rates and best-selling records and everything in between. Winners win big because the marketplace loves a winner. Here's another example. These are box office rankings from a particularly bad week at the movies in August 2006. Invincible, Talladega Nights, Little Miss Sunshine, Beer Fest, World Trade Center, Accepted, Snakes on a Plane, Step Up, Idlewild, Barnyard. It's hard to feel sorry for the horrible movie Beer Fest. After all, it came in fourth. But a look at the chart of actual revenue shows that the number one movie of the week, Invincible, did better than almost all the other movies put together. If you've read Chris Anderson's The Long Tail, this isn't news to you. But I don't care about the long tail right now. I want to show you the short head. The short, big, profitable head. That's the juicy share of the market that belongs to the people at the top of the list. People don't have a lot of time and don't want to take a lot of risks. If you've been diagnosed with cancer of the navel, you're not going to mess around by going to a lot of doctors. You're going to head straight for the top guy, the person who's ranked the best in the world. Why screw around if you only get one chance? When you visit a new town, are you the sort of person who wants to visit a typical restaurant, or do you ask the concierge for the best place? When you're hiring someone for your team, do you ask your admin to give you the average resume, or do you ask him to screen out all but the very best qualified people? With limited time or opportunity to experiment, we intentionally narrow our choices to those at the top. You're not the only person who looks for the best choice. Everyone does. As a result, the rewards for being first are enormous. It's not a linear scale. It's not a matter of getting a little bit more after giving a little more. It's a curve, and a steep one. The second reason there are such tremendous benefits to being number one is a little more subtle. Being at the top matters because there's room at the top for only a few. Scarcity makes being at the top worth something. There are hundreds of brands of bottled water, and they're all mostly the same. So we don't shop around for bottled water. There is no top for bottled water. Champagne is a different story. Dom Perignon is at or near the top, so we pay extra for it. Where does the scarcity come from? It comes from the hurdles that the markets and our society set up. It comes from the fact that most competitors quit long before they've created something that makes it to the top. That's the way it's supposed to be. The system depends on it. Anyone who is going to hire you, buy from you, recommend you, vote for you, or do what you want them to do is going to wonder if you're the best choice. Best, as in best for them, right now, based on what they believe and what they know. And in the world, as in their world, the world they have access to. So, if I'm looking for a freelance copy editor, I want the best copy editor in English who's available, who can find a way to work with me at a price I can afford. That's my best in the world. If I want a hernia doctor, I want the doctor who is best because she's recommended by my friends or colleagues and because she fits my picture of what a great doctor is. That and she has to be in my town and have a slot open. So world is a pretty flexible term. The mass market is dying. There is no longer one best song or one best kind of coffee. Now there are a million micro-markets, but each micro-market still has a best. If your micro-market is organic markets in Tulsa, then that's your world. And being the best in that world is the place to be. Best is subjective. I, the consumer, get to decide, not you. World is selfish. It's my definition, not yours. It's the world I define based on my convenience or my preferences. Be the best in my world, and you have me at a premium right now. The world is getting larger because I can now look everywhere when I want to find something or someone. That means that the amount of variety is staggering, and it means I can define my world to be exactly what I have an interest in and find my preferences anywhere on the planet. At the same time, the world is getting smaller because the categories are getting more specialized. I can now find the best gluten-free Bialys available by overnight shipping. I can find the best risk management software for my industry right now online. I can find the best clothing optional resort in North America with 6 clicks of a mouse. So while it's more important than ever to be the best in the world, it's also easier if you pick the right thing and do it all the way. More places to win, and the stakes are higher too. Andy Warhol was the best in the world. So is the Shripify Thai restaurant in Queens. So is my editor. So are you, if you want to be. If you're not sold on being the best in the world, you probably don't need the rest of what I'm about to tell you. But if you're sold on being the best, but you've been frustrated in the route you're taking to get there, then you need to start doing some quitting. The problem with infinity is that there's just too much of it. And in just about every market, the number of choices is approaching infinity. Faced with infinity, people panic. Sometimes they don't buy anything. Sometimes they buy the cheapest one of whatever they're shopping for. Faced with an infinite number of choices, many people pick the market leader. Best-selling books still outsell backlist titles. Websites highlighted on Dig still get 100 times as much traffic as ordinary sites. Big insurance companies get clients just because they're big. The number of job seekers is approaching infinity. So is the number of professional services firms, lawyers, manicure shops, coffee bars, and brands of soap. Better to be the best. Job applications in all capital letters. Junk mail with a misspelled name. Salespeople who are eager to open an account but never follow up. Doctors that don't bother to call to see if a new medication worked for a long-time patient. People settle. They settle for less than they are capable of. Organizations settle too. For good enough instead of best in the world. If you're not going to put in the effort to be my best possible choice, why bother? Is, well, no one better showed up, a valid strategy for success? Are you hoping to become a success because you're the only one being considered? The reason that big companies almost always fail when they try to enter new markets is their willingness to compromise. They figure that because they are big and powerful, they can settle, do less, stop improving something before it is truly remarkable. They compromise to avoid offending other divisions or to minimize their exposure. So they fail. They fail because they don't know when to quit and when to refuse to settle. Just about everything you learned in school about life is wrong, but the wrongest thing might very well be this. Being well-rounded is the secret to success. When you come home from school with 2 A's, a B+, and 3 B's, you are doing just fine. Imagine the poor kid who had an A+ and 4 C's. Boy, was he in trouble. Fast forward a few decades from those school days and think about the decisions you make today. about which doctor to pick, which restaurant to visit, or which accountant to hire. How often do you look for someone who is actually quite good at the things you don't need her to do? How often do you hope that your accountant is a safe driver and a decent golfer? In a free market, we reward the exceptional. In school, we tell kids that once something gets too hard, move on and focus on the next thing. The low-hanging fruit is there to be taken. No sense wasting time climbing the tree. Here's a quote from a test-taking book. Skim through the questions and answer the easiest ones first, skipping ones you don't know immediately. Bad advice. Superstars can't skip the ones they don't know. In fact, the people who are the best in the world specialize at getting really good at the questions they don't know. The people who skip the hard questions are in the majority, but they are not in demand. Many organizations make sure that they've dotted all their I's. They have customer service, a receptionist, a convenient location, a brochure, and on and on. And all of it is mediocre. More often than not, prospects choose someone else, their competition. Those competitors can't perform in some areas, but they're exceptional in the ones that matter. The magic of thinking quit. 20 years ago, I read a book that changed my life. It was called The Magic of Thinking Big. I actually don't remember anything about the book at all. What I do remember is that in one quick moment, it changed the way I thought about success. My hope is that the next minute or two might do the same for you. I want to change the way you think about success and quitting. Most people will tell you that you need to persevere, to try harder, put in more hours, get more training, and work hard. Don't quit, they implore. But if all you need to do to succeed is not quit, then why do organizations less motivated than yours succeed? Why do individuals less talented than you win? It involves understanding the architecture of quitting. And believe it or not, it means quitting a lot more than you do now. Strategic quitting is the secret of successful organizations. Reactive quitting and serial quitting are the bane of those that strive and fail to get what they want. And most people do just the opposite. They quit when it's painful and stick when they can't be bothered to quit. There are two curves that define almost any type of situation facing you as you try to accomplish something. A couple of minor curves cover the rest. Understanding the different types of situations that lead you to quit or that should cause you to quit is the first step toward getting what you want. Curve number one, the dip. Almost everything in life worth doing is controlled by the dip. You can see a picture of it on the cover of this program. At the beginning, when you first start something, it's fun. You could be taking up golf or acupuncture or piloting a plane or doing chemistry. Doesn't matter. It's interesting, and you get plenty of good feedback from the people around you. Over the next few days and weeks, the rapid learning you experience keeps you going. Whatever your new thing is, it's easy to stay engaged in it. And then the dip happens. The dip is the long slog between starting and mastery. A long slog that's actually a shortcut because it gets you where you want to go faster than any other path. The dip is the combination of bureaucracy and busy work you must deal with in order to get certified in scuba diving. The dip is the difference between the easy beginner technique and the more useful expert approach in skiing or fashion design. The dip is the long stretch between beginner's luck and real accomplishment. The dip is the set of artificial screens set up to keep people like you out. If you took organic chemistry in college, you've experienced the dip. Academia doesn't want too many unmotivated people to attempt medical school, so they set up a screen. Organic chemistry is the killer class, the screen that separates the doctors from the psychologists. If you can't handle organic chemistry, well then, you can't go to med school. At the beginning, when you announce that you're pre-med, you get all sorts of positive feedback and support. Your grandmother can't believe her good fortune. But soon, The mind-numbing grind of organic chemistry kicks in, and you realize you're doomed. At trade shows, you see dozens of companies trying to break into an industry. They've invested time and money to build a product, to create a marketing organization, and rent booth space, all in an attempt to break into a lucrative market. A year later, most of them don't return. They're gone, unable to get through the dip. The same thing happens to people who dream of the untold riches and power that accrue to the CEO of a Fortune 500 company. Private jets, fancy country clubs, unchecked decision-making power. Who wouldn't want to live like modern-day royalty? Of course, if you look at the resume of a typical CEO, you'll see that he endured a 25-year dip before landing the job. For a quarter of a century, he needed to suck it up, keep his head down, and do what he was told. He needed to hit his numbers, work longer hours than everyone else, and kiss up to his boss in the moment, day in and day out, year after year. It's easy to be a CEO. What's hard is getting there. There's a huge dip along the way. If it was easy, there'd be too many people vying for the job, and CEOs couldn't get paid as much, could they? Scarcity, as we've seen, is the secret to value. If there weren't a dip, there'd be no scarcity. Important note. Successful people don't just ride out the dip. They don't just buckle down and survive it. No, they lean into the dip. They seek out the dip. They push harder, changing the rules as they go. Just because you know you're in the dip doesn't mean you have to live happily with it. Dips don't last quite as long when you whittle at them. Curve 2. The cul-de-sac. The cul-de-sac, French for dead end, is so simple it doesn't even need a graph. It's a situation where you work and you work and you work and nothing much changes. It doesn't get a lot better. It doesn't get a lot worse. It just is. That's why they call those jobs dead-end jobs. There's not a lot to say about the cul-de-sac except to realize that it exists and to embrace the fact that when you find one, you need to get off it fast. That's because a dead end is keeping you from doing something else. The opportunity cost of investing your life in something that's not going to get better is just too high. That's it. Two big curves. Stick with the dips that are likely to pan out and quit the cul-de-sacs to focus your resources. That's it. Here's a bonus curve. The cliff. Cigarettes, it turns out, were redesigned by scientists to be particularly addictive. If you were going to draw a chart of the pleasures of smoking over time, it would go up at an angle and then drop really fast, like a cliff. Except for that nasty drop-off at the end, otherwise known as emphysema, smoking is a marketer's dream come true. Because smoking is designed to be almost impossible to quit, the longer you do it, the better it feels to continue smoking. The pain of quitting just gets bigger and bigger over time. I call this curve a cliff. It's a situation where you can't quit until you fall off and the whole thing falls apart. It's no wonder that people have trouble stopping. The thing is, a profession in selling isn't like smoking cigarettes. Neither is making it as a singer or building a long-term relationship with someone you care about. Most of the time, the other two curves are in force. The dip and the cul-de-sac aren't linear. They don't spoon-feed you with little bits of improvement every day, and they're just waiting to trip you up. If something is worth doing, there's probably a dip. Tennis has a dip. The difference between a mediocre club player and a regional champion isn't inborn talent. It's the ability to push through the moments where it's just easier to quit. Politics has a dip as well. It's way more fun to win an election than to lose one, and the entire process is built around many people starting, while most people end up quitting. The dip creates scarcity. Scarcity creates value. If you find yourself facing the cliff or the cul-de-sac, you need to quit. Not soon, but right now. The biggest obstacle to success in life, as far as I can tell, is our inability to quit these curves soon enough. It's easy to complain that the advice in this little program is brain dead obvious. I mean, who doesn't already know that the secret to success is to be successful? That providing a great product or service is the right thing to do, and that you shouldn't quit in the face of adversity. You don't. That's the bad news. The good news is that your boss and your competitors don't know either. I mean, you know it, but my guess is that you're not doing anything about it. When it comes right down to it, right down to the hard decisions, are you quitting any project that isn't a dip? Or is it easier not to rock the boat, to hang in there, to avoid the short-term hassle of changing paths? What's the point of sticking it out if you're not going to get the benefits of being the best in the world? Are you overinvesting, really significantly overinvesting time and money so that you have a much greater chance of dominating a market? And if you don't have enough time and money, do you have the guts to pick a different, smaller market to conquer? Once you're doing those things, then you get it. If you haven't already realized it, the dip is the secret to your success. The people who set out to make it through the dip, the people who invest the time and the energy and the effort to power through the dip, those are the ones who become the best in the world. They are breaking the system because instead of moving on to the next thing, instead of doing slightly above average and settling for what they've got, they embrace the challenge. For whatever reason, they refuse to abandon the quest and they push through the dip all the way to the next level. Snowboarding is a hip sport. It's fast, exciting, and reasonably priced, and it makes you look very cool. So why are there so few snowboarders? Because learning the basic skills constitutes a painful dip. It takes a few days to get the hang of it, and during those few days, you'll get pretty banged up. It's easier to quit than it is to keep going. The brave thing to do is to tough it out and end up on the other side, getting all the benefits that come from scarcity. The mature thing is not even to bother starting to snowboard, because you're probably not going to make it through the dip. And the stupid thing to do is to start, give it your best shot, waste a lot of time and money, and quit right in the middle of the dip. A few people will choose to do the brave thing and end up the best in the world. Informed people will probably choose to do the mature thing and save their resources for a project they're truly passionate about. Both are fine choices. It's the last choice, the common choice, the choice to give it a shot and then quit that you must avoid if you want to succeed. When Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid were being chased across the Badlands by Charlie Siringo and agents from Pinkertons, Butch kept heading for the hills, for tougher and tougher terrain. Why? Because he knew that in open country, he and Sundance would never have a shot at escape. Only if they got through the impassable hills ahead would there be a chance that the Pinkertons guys would quit. The harder it got, the better it was for Butch. But the Pinkertons posse persisted. It wasn't until Butch and Sundance faced certain death that they escaped. Hey, it worked in the movie. Your marketplace is competitive, filled with people overcoming challenges every day. It's the incredibly difficult challenges, the dips, that give you the opportunity to pull ahead. In a competitive world, adversity is your ally. The harder it gets, the better chance you have of insulating yourself from the competition. If that adversity also causes you to quit, though, it's all for nothing. When Jack Welch remade GE, the most fabled decision he made was this: if we can't be number one or number two in an industry, we must get out. Why sell a billion-dollar division that's making a profit quite happily while ranking number four in market share? Easy. Because it distracts management attention. It sucks resources and capital and focus and energy. And most of all, it teaches people in the organization that it's okay not to be the best in the world. Jack quit the dead ends. By doing so, he freed resources to get his other businesses through the dip. I can tell you that windsurfing is very easy, except for the wind. The wind makes it tricky, of course. It's not particularly difficult to find and rent great equipment, and the techniques are fairly straightforward. What messes the whole plan up is the fact that the wind is unpredictable. It'll change exactly when you don't want it to. The same thing is true about customer service. It would be a lot easier if it weren't for the customers. In fact, every single function of an organization has a wind problem. Accounting would be easy if every incoming report were accurate and on time. Sales would be easy if it weren't for the prospects not buying from you all the time. Marketing would be easy if every prospect and customer thought the way you do. Here's the good news. The fact that it's difficult and unpredictable works to your advantage, because if it were any other way, there'd be no profit in it. The reason people bother to go windsurfing is that the challenge makes it interesting. The driving force that gets people to pay a specialist is that their disease is unpredictable or hard to diagnose. The reason we're here is to solve the hard problems. The next time you're tempted to vilify a particularly obnoxious customer or agency or search engine, realize that this failed interaction is the best thing that's happened to you all day long. Without it, you'd be easily replaceable. The dip is your very best friend. If I could offer just one piece of inspiration, it's this. The dip is the reason you're here. Whether you're lifting weights or negotiating a sale or applying for a job or lunging for a tennis ball, you've made a huge investment. You've invested time and money and effort to get to this moment. You've acquired the equipment and the education and the reputation, all so you can confront this dip right now. The dip is the reason you're here. It's not enough to survive your way through the dip. You get what you deserve when you embrace the dip and treat it like the opportunity that it really is. When faced with the dip, many individuals and organizations diversify. If you can't get to the next level, the thinking goes, invest your energy in learning to do something else. This leads to record labels with thousands of artists instead of focused promotion for just a few. It leads to job seekers who can demonstrate competency at a dozen tasks instead of mastery of just one. Hardworking, motivated people find diversification a natural outlet for their energy and drive. Diversification feels like the right thing to do. Enter a new market, apply for a job in a new area, start a new sport. Who knows? This might just be the one. And yet, the real success goes to those who obsess. The focus that leads you through the dip to the other side is rewarded by a marketplace in search of the best in the world. A woodpecker can tap 20 times on 1,000 trees and get nowhere but stay busy. Or he can tap 20,000 times on one tree and get dinner. Before you enter a new market, consider what would happen if you managed to get through the dip and win in the market you're already in. It's easier to be mediocre than it is to confront reality and quit. In fact, most people are afraid to quit. Quitting is difficult. Quitting requires you to acknowledge that you're never going to be number one in the world, at least not at this. So it's easier to just put it off, not admit it, settle for mediocre. What a waste. You should be angry now. I know I am. I'm angry at all the worthwhile organizations that stick with a cul-de-sac instead of leaving it and investing their resources where they belong. I'm angry at all the people who have wasted time and money trying to get through a dip that they should have realized was too big and too deep to get through with the resources they had available. Mostly, I'm angry that it took me this long to be able to describe how simple the solution is. The essential thing to know about the dip is that it's there. Knowing that you're facing a dip is the first step in getting through it. Every time Men's Health magazine puts a picture of a guy with washboard abs on their cover, newsstand sales go up. Why? Well, if everyone had washboard abs, it's unlikely that men would buy a magazine that teaches them how to get that physique. The very scarcity of this attribute makes it attractive. Weight training is a fascinating science. Basically, you do a minute or two of work for no reason other than to tire out your muscle, so that the last few seconds of work will cause that muscle to grow. Like most people, all day long, every day, you use your muscles. But they don't grow. You don't look like Mr. Universe because you quit using your muscles before you reach the moment when the stress causes them to start growing. It's the natural thing to do, because an exhausted muscle feels unsafe, and it hurts. People who train successfully pay their dues for the first minute or two and then get all the benefits at the very end. Unsuccessful trainers pay exactly the same dues, but stop a few seconds too early. It's human nature to quit when it hurts, but it's that reflex that creates scarcity. The challenge is simple. Quitting when you hit the dip is a bad idea. If the journey you started was worth doing, then quitting when you hit the dip just wastes the time you've already invested. Quit in the dip often enough, and you'll find yourself becoming a serial quitter, starting many things but accomplishing little. Simple. If you can't make it through the dip, don't start. If you can embrace that simple rule, you'll be a lot choosier about which journeys you start. Superstars get what they want because they have unique skills. Superstars command far more than their fair share of income, respect, and opportunity because there are very few other choices for a customer or an employer seeking the extraordinary. A superstar real estate agent gets 5 or 10 times the number of listings as an ordinary one. A superstar lawyer has all the work she can handle, regardless of her specialty. A superstar musician commands 1,000 times the income per performance as an average musician. A superstar is the best in the world at what she does. If you want to be a superstar, then you need to find a field with a steep dip, a barrier between those who try and those who succeed. And you've got to get through that dip to the other side. This isn't for everyone. If it were, there'd be no superstars. If you choose this path, it's because you realize that there's a dip and you believe you can get through it. The dip is actually your greatest ally because it makes the project worthwhile and keeps others from competing with you. But wait, that's not enough. Not only do you need to find a dip that you can conquer, but you also need to quit all the cul-de-sacs that you're currently idling your way through. You must quit the projects and investments and endeavors that don't offer you the same opportunity. Being better than 98% of the competition used to be fine. In the world of Google, though, it's useless. It's useless because all of your competition is just a click away, whatever it is you do. The only position you can count on now is best in the world. Here are 7 reasons you might fail to become the best in the world. 1, you run out of time and quit. 2, you run out of money and quit. 3, you get scared and quit. 4, you're not serious about it and quit. 5, you lose interest or enthusiasm or settle for being mediocre and quit. 6, you focus on the short term instead of the long and quit when the short term gets too hard. 7, you pick the wrong thing at which to be the best in the world at because you don't have the talent. By you, I mean your team, your company, or just plain you, the job seeker, the employee, or the entrepreneur. The important thing to remember about these 7 things is that you can plan for them. You can know before you start whether or not you have the resources and the will to get to the end. Most of the time, if you fail to become the best in the world, it's either because you planned wrong or because you gave up before you reached your goal. Is it possible that you're just not good enough? That you or your team just don't have enough talent to be the best in the world? Sure, it's possible. In fact, if your chosen area is the cello or speed skating, then I might even say it's probable. But in just about every relevant area I can think of, no, it's not likely. You are good enough. The question is, will you take the shortcut you need to get really good at this? One of the underpinnings of the dip is the pyramid. A pyramid scheme is a scam in which the people at the bottom support the guy at the top. But it's not always a scam. In fact, it happens a lot more than you realize. For example, lots of people sign up for a health club membership. Having a lot of members lets the club keep rates reasonable. But the club itself is small because very few people actually come frequently after they join. That's built into the system. If everyone who joined came, you'd never be able to find an empty bike or to afford a membership. Netflix gives you an unlimited number of DVD rentals a month, postage paid, for $10. How can this be? If you watched a movie the day it came in and sent it right back, you get to see at least 6 movies for $10. Of course, the key is that for every person who sees 6, there are plenty of people who lose interest and see 1 movie or even no movies a month. These people subsidize the committed members. Sure, Netflix wants you to see a lot of movies. That makes you a loyal customer. But the economics of the entire business would fall apart if it weren't for the uncommitted users who just dabble. For a long time, airlines oversold their flights because they knew they would profit from the no-shows. Politicians fully expect that the lazy and ill-informed won't bother to vote. These citizens pay taxes, which support the political life of the few who don't quit the system. And of course, the entire college football money machine is based on a pyramid scheme of players who aspire to the NFL but will never make it. Whatever you do for a living or for fun, it's probably somehow based on a system that's based on quitting. Quitting creates scarcity. Scarcity creates value. In The Wizard of Oz, there's an indelible image of the man behind the curtain, laughing at Dorothy and her friends as he gives them incredibly difficult, almost impossible tasks to accomplish. While he lives the easy life in Oz, he supports himself by sending his acolytes off on impossible missions. It's no wonder we quit. The system wants us to. Here are 8 systems that are dependent on dips. These dips are in the places where organizations and individuals are most likely to give up. If you see these dips coming, you're more likely to make a choice. You can choose, in advance, to do whatever you need to in order to get through the dip, knowing it's going to be difficult, or you can give up before you get there. Quitting in the dip, though, isn't worth the journey. The manufacturing dip. It's easy and fun to start building something in your garage. It's difficult and expensive to buy an injection mold, design an integrated circuit, or ramp up for large-scale production. The time and effort and cost of ramping up your operation creates the dip. The dip keeps the supply of stuff down and insulates those brave enough to invest in scaling up their production. Those struggling artists at the local craft fair are struggling because they don't have the guts or the wherewithal to take their work to the next level. The sales dip. Most ideas get their start when one person, you, starts selling it. Selling the idea to stores or to businesses or to consumers or even to voters. But the dip hits when you need to upgrade to a professional sales force and scale it up. In almost every field, the competitor that's first with a big, aggressive sales force has a huge advantage. The education dip. A career gets started as soon as you leave school. But the dip often hits when it's time to learn something new, to reinvent or rebuild your skills. A doctor who sacrifices a year of her life for a specialty reaps the rewards for decades afterward. The risk dip. Bootstrappers learn the hard way that at some point they can't pay for it all themselves, especially out of current income. It takes a risk to rent a bigger space or invest in new techniques. Successful entrepreneurs understand the difference between investing to get through the dip, a smart move, or investing in something that's actually a risky crapshoot. The relationship dip. There are people and organizations that can help you later, but only if you invest the time and effort to work with them now, even though now is not necessarily the easy time for you to do it. That kid who started in the mailroom, who was always eager to do an errand for you or stay late to help out. She's now the CEO. The relationship she built when it was difficult to do so paid off later. Those short-sighted people who are always eager for a favor or a break never managed to get through the relationship dip because they didn't invest in relationships back when it was difficult, but not urgent. The conceptual dip. You got this far operating under one set of assumptions. Abandoning those assumptions and embracing a new, bigger set may be exactly what you need to do to get to the next level.